Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Othello, a play that the director, who is also the artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, has wanted to do for a very long time, has now had his dream come true, and Othello is on stage here in Milwaukee. And we have with us this hour the director, Mark Clements, who is relatively new to the city, and I have yet to have a chance to meet him, so this will be fun. And also the actor who is playing Othello is with us. Mark Clements is director of Othello and also artistic director of the Milwaukee Rep. He started his work in the 2010-11 season. He's an award-winning international theater director. His work, I mean, I could go on for 5 minutes, so I won't, but give me a moment here. His work has appeared in over 100 major theaters throughout Europe and the U.S. Recent productions here, some of you may be familiar with, include Next to Normal, Death of a Salesman, Bombshells, and Cabaret. He's done many shows for the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia, the Roundabout Theater Company, Associate Artistic Director for Moving Theater Company, founded by Vanessa and Corin Redgrave, New End Theater and New Players Theater in London, and the Derby Playhouse in the UK. And it's a great pleasure to meet you, Mark. You're good. You know?
Allegedly.
I say you're good.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
I was like thinking why I'm so tired this morning. I was thinking about that resume. It seemed very long.
And that's only this much of it, just a little bit.
I know. It's long.
Yeah. Lindsay Smiling is also with us. Lindsay is playing Othello in the Rep's show, which is going on until May 6th. He's making his Milwaukee Rep Theater debut. His recent credits, As You Like It for the Pittsburgh Public Theater, Othello, Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, Superior Donuts, Dorset Theater Festival, Treasure Island Off-Broadway, Charlotte's Web, Macbeth, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare on the Sound, and the list goes on. He's also done film and TV work, including Hack, As the World Turns, The Daily Grind, and Brother. Lindsay, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I just have enormous respect for people who can do Shakespeare. I just think it's an amazing thing to be able to do. Let's start with both of you and your work in theater, and then we'll get into Othello. Mark, I've heard you say that you were happy to come to this city. It's really kind of a different thing for somebody who's been, you know, all over the world to settle in. I know you had a baby recently, to this community, and I think you like it, don't you?
Oh, very much. Yeah, we, you know, I drive along the lake every day. And you know, I feel really grateful for where I live. You know, I'm very privileged because I get a chance to travel a lot. But prior to coming here, I was doing, you know, 5 or 6 years of freelance, and I literally lived out of a suitcase for most of that time because I was just going from gig to gig. And, you know, there was a time, I think in 1 year, I think in 2006, seven, around about that time, that I had two houses in the UK. And I spent 4 days collectively in both of them, you know, so I never got home. And prior to that, I had run Derby Playhouse for 10 years, which is a, you know, large-scale regional theater in the UK. And, you know, so it has a lot of similarities to Milwaukee in a way. And I, you know, with beautiful countryside outside, but, you know, with a really good standard of living, with restaurants, good restaurants, wonderful music scene. And I was saying to your producer who's just moved here this morning, I think, you know, he's got things
Brett's
to look.
Just here from
yeah,
New York, right?
Yeah, he's got, you know, I think he's gonna enjoy it, you know. But obviously when you leave a big city, you're going to go, oh, am I going to, you know, what am I going to miss? But actually, I haven't really missed anything. And, you know, I do travel a lot anyway, so I have the best of both worlds. And as you said, I'm a new dad. So just having, you know, the idea of bringing her up, not in Manhattan, actually, or central London, actually is more of an attractive proposition. Mm-hmm. You start thinking about things in a different way.
We should also say your wife is playing Patsy Cline at the Stechner Cabaret.
Yeah,
it's a great show. She is phenomenally talented.
Yeah, Kelly Faulkner. You know, she's I don't know what I did to deserve to get her, but she's wonderful. And
and your daughter is a comedian, even though she's only
she's
6 months old.
She's 8 months old next week, and she's. You know, she's just at that point where, you know, we're kind of completely enraptured and enthralled at every single thing she does, and, like, you know, just thinks she's so funny, and already she's really headstrong. I don't know where she got that from, but...
No, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Lindsay, where do you live?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because I actually kind of don't live anywhere right
you
now.
You don't.
I mean, I'm based out of New York, but For the last 3 years, I've been in between a permanent place. So I just, you know, kind of like Mark has described, I go from gig to gig. You know, I was just in Pittsburgh, and, you know, I was out in Jersey quite a bit. And, you know, I spend a couple months back in New York at a time and, you know, look for a place to live. And then inevitably I get some other regional gig that takes me out of the city. I actually grew up outside of Chicago.
Oh, you did? So
yeah.
Did I. Where are you from?
Bloomingdale.
Oh.
Yes, out in the burbs, right by Schaumburg and Wheaton and all that.
Sure.
And then went to grad school in at Temple in Philadelphia. And I was, you know, I'm like on the East Coast. I'm just got out of grad school, got to try New York, and have kind of been not living in New York, but based out of New York ever since. So, yeah, it's kind of, you know, a certain type of lifestyle for an actor that you got to take what comes to you.
Right.
You know?
And do you consider yourself primarily a Shakespearean actor? You've done a lot of Shakespeare.
No, that's kind of been a new thing, actually.
Really?
Relatively in my career. I mean, it's been about the last 3 or 4 years that it's kind of been a regular thing. When I first got out of grad school, Temple's a classical training program, but I just wasn't getting called. And, you know, part of it is... you know, I'm a bigger guy, and so a lot of the parts that I'm right for are just older. You know, they're not going to cast me as an ingenue at 6'3", coming out of grad school. So, I think I have growing into those parts, the Shakespeare parts that I'm right for. And it's been pretty consistent over these last 3 or 4 years that I've been doing a lot of Shakespeare, and it's been a, you know, joy to do, because, you know, number one, it's work, but also just get to do the magnitude of these parts are fantastic.
It's Shakespeare.
It's Shakespeare. It's Shakespeare.
Get much better.
Yeah, there's something to do, you know, conversational speech, but then also to do these you know, sweeping monologues and soliloquies. It's a joy.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah. And you, I read, Mark, had an idea. I don't know how the heck it came into your head, but you had the idea some 20 years ago that you wanted to do Shakespeare with motorcycle gangs. Is that right? 20 years ago?
Well, I was 6 at the time. I'm kind of really regretting giving that bit of information out now. Yeah, I did. Well, I've always had this obsession with motorcycles. I mean, what I remember of my childhood is mealtimes in constant conflict and rowing with my parents about, yes, I will have a motorcycle, I do want one, and no, you cannot have one and never will have one, of course, which is the worst thing to say to a child.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know. I've always had this love of them. I've been interested pretty much in everything to do with them from, you know, just in terms of looking at them and... not so much the mechanics of them. I just want to ride them, really. I raced them for 5 years. I raced motocross for 5 years and never had an injury as well, so, which was kind of pretty amazing, because that's pretty unusual in that field. I mean, not a serious injury, thankfully. But, I had this idea. I was always interested in motorcycle club culture. And how these guys operate. And I remember seeing a production of Othello, you know, probably 20 years ago, and kind of being kind of bored by it and let my mind wander and thinking, you know, what would I do with that? You know, if ever I got to direct that play, what would I do? And it was sort of at that time I thought, oh my God, these guys are so, their lifestyle in some ways is so similar to the way that kind of the hardcore 1%ers, their known like biking fraternity, exist, you know, they live in our society, but they don't really, you know, they don't necessarily recognize that as a society which they adhere to from rules, and the strongest guy in the pack is the leader, and, you know, and it's hard to get in that, in those organizations, and even tougher to get out. And the patch that they have wear on their back, as it's called, it's sacred and to them, and it's put above everything else. And a lot of those themes and that lifestyle is actually, you know, not that far away from and akin to the protagonist that we see in Shakespeare's play, which was written 409 years ago. And when people see the play, I mean, although it's set in a modern context, we actually haven't changed a single word of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that isn't actually strictly true. We have changed I think, about 12 or 13 words, maybe.
That's it.
But those words were actually taken from other Shakespearean texts rather than, words using modern vernacular. So it's pretty truthful in terms of its presentation. There are some cuts in there, but nothing's actually changed, and there is real no major juxtaposition either, a little bit. But it's pretty much as it comes off the page.
So, Lindsay, did you have to get a pretty thorough understanding of motorcycle culture and that 1% that Mark was talking about to play Othello?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first week of rehearsals, we were definitely, doing all the research. Mark had sent out a bunch of, clips from YouTube and just materials to the actors, an encyclopedia, reference points to look at. Sons of Anarchy, we looked at that, and there's a lot of programs on Discovery Channel and biography about motorcycle gangs. We didn't want to do it like, a Disney version of motorcycle clubs. We wanted these people to be living, breathing people and be unapologetic for who they were. So, we tried to be as truthful as we could. And I think it was funny because when I first started rehearsals and I'm looking at this group of interns and, these actors, I'm like, there's no way we're going to pull this off. No way. And it's a real testament to just my fellow act, my casts, and also just the costume design and everybody who's working on the show, from the set designers to the stage artisans. I mean, they made it gritty, and when we got onto that set, we're like, oh man, and
it's quite a set.
And
it's
look
really
at these
something.
People, these actors, and I was like, these are the same people. It's still remarkable, even in midway in the run.
And let's talk about the issue of race in this play.
Sure.
Because there's so many things going on. You got the motorcycle culture. Mm-hmm. You're also an African American actor. Mm-hmm. This play has a whole history of being done in blackface, being done by Paul Robeson,
sure,
who made it very famous. It's being done with an all black cast with one white actor. Mm-hmm. How does that? Is that a whole other dimension? Does it fit into the motorcycle culture in some way? Is there? What's the statement about race to you in this play, to both of you, to Mark?
Sure,
your
sure.
Response to?
It's interesting because, whenever we do this, I've done the show, once in Jersey, and, race comes up. I don't think the play's necessarily particularly about race, but it brings the issue to the forefront. It's not, it's not dealing with race. It's not, we're not dealing with the effects of racism with Othello. He's just black in the white world, and it's circumstantial, certainly that affects the relationships in the play to a certain degree, but it's not necessarily dealing with the greater issue of racism. But what happens is whenever this is the second time I've done this show, is that it creates this discussion about race and I mean, and because this play, from its onset is, it's a white actor playing a black part, and even critics didn't know what to think of it when it first came out. It was successful, I think, partly because of the taboo of it, and it says something about our culture where we are whenever you're doing this show, and so... as far as, in this particular production, certainly, there's not too many interracial motorcycle clubs out there in general. So to have this African-American person leading a part of this club is risky. There's controversy around it. So, as far as like a statement goes, I don't know how much of a statement it makes. I think just doing the show creates discussion no matter what.
Yeah.
Just the mere fact of it's a black man in a white world.
And I know this comes on the heels of your fantastic To Kill a Mockingbird, which I thought was just superb. And I know that you think about issues of race living in this community, Mark, and you just think about them. So it had to be in your mind as you were directing this play. How was it?
About the issues of race?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the privileges for me of directing plays and in fact running an organization, a large organization that produces 12 plays a year currently, is that we do have an opportunity to choose topics and create provocative conversation, which a necessary conversation. So for me, that is there's a real plus in that, and an opportunity there that would be remiss to do. I've been surprised that I love living in Milwaukee, but I do find it, I do have experiences here that I haven't had in bigger cities, and there are statistics that show that we are in Milwaukee a long way away from, real kind of racial harmony, and that actually we are one of the most segregated cities still in this country, and so in my small way, I don't think that's something that I feel good about or want to, many of my friends and people I know who live here. But, I actually have a mini, mini opportunity, albeit, to actually do something about it and exercise my voice. And that's kind of what I'm doing. And certainly, I feel like the issues of diversity in our particular organization, maybe that's an area that we could be stronger in and need to be stronger in. And, I think it's recognized in our organization and our board is supportive of that, and something that, you will see, in fact, in next season's work. The things that we're doing next season have stepped that up quite considerably.
What are they? What are you
doing? Well, we're doing things like Bruce Norris's Clybourne Park, which is one of the most brilliant plays I think to be written in the last 10 years, and we're doing that in conversation. It's a riff on Raisin in the Sun, so we're actually doing Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, and we're doing those two plays back to back in the Powerhouse Theatre. We're doing Mountaintop, which is a piece about Martin Luther King Jr. on the last night of his life, and
love that speech.
Yeah, and I don't think, they are necessarily what you would call, just African-American plays. I think they're plays with a black theme in them, but they are not necessarily, I think they're plays that should be of interest and are of interest and have great theatrical merit. And we're really proud to be doing them, but we've chosen them very specifically because we are interested in having the conversation about diversity in our community and how we can all be a little bit better at it.
Good. I'm really glad you're doing it. We can't have enough of that.
Right.
So let's talk about Shakespeare, and we'll do that in a moment. And we'll welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Othello and about a number of issues. Mark Clements, director of Othello, artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, now in his second season. Lindsay Smiling, who plays Othello and is making his Milwaukee Rep Theater debut, are with us in our Milwaukee studios. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who have seen the play, and I know our first caller has seen the play because Brett and I saw him at the Sunday performance, so that's good. But if you haven't, that's fine as well. It's a very different production because it takes place in the world of motorcycle gangs, which I don't know how many of you have seen Othello done that way, but it's a very unusual. We heard why it's being done that way. And so here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Rich in Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi. I saw this production over the weekend, and I'm a big fan of the Milwaukee Rep. I saw your Next to Normal, and I had actually seen Next to Normal with Alice Ripley. She was on stage, and I was in the audience, and yours was better. and that's quite a compliment. And I like these kind of productions. I'll reference a couple films here. I like Richard III, 1995, with Robert Downey Jr. and Ian McClellan, and I like Romeo and Juliet in 1996 with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. So I kind of like these Shakespeare costumed in somewhat modern dress. However, when I saw Othello, and I think it's worth every penny to see it, the pacing of it, my word, man, the pacing of it, particularly in the first sections, I think you should, when you sell tickets, tell people that they can't come to see the play unless they've done their homework so they know who everybody is as it starts, because this is a motorcycle gang production, and by that I mean it moves fast, and boy, I just like to have you speak to the issue of pacing in Shakespeare, particularly for modern American audiences, and when you're doing something like this.
Mm. Well, thank you for your, this is Mark here, and thank you for your nice comments about this and other productions. We've only been open a short while, and we had quite a short rehearsal period comparatively to do this complicated play anyway, and then kind of package it in a concept that is, you know, required a huge amount of technical support and underpinning. You know, we have fire on stage, we have weapons firing, we have motorcycles and all of those things. You know, you can't just roll those out and do those in 5 minutes, so the tech time that we took was a lot, and we were really relying on, you know, my wonderful actors to, you know, kind of take care of their side of things for a while, and then we were also mindful that this is a play that uncut in a First Folio form could and would. In fact, there was a production recently in New York with Philip Seymour Hoffman that just touched the 4-hour mark, and I mean, whilst I'm not adverse to sitting and watching a play for 4 hours, I think that's a tough thing for a lot of people to do these days, and especially one of the things that I was trying to do was honor the purity of the language of Shakespeare and not dumb it down, but also make it accessible to a newer and a younger audience and people who are discovering it for the first time, or thinking that they didn't like it and wouldn't want to come and see it anyway. You know, so those are things, big things for me as a person who runs a large arts organization, is somebody, you know, I want people to discover us. I want people to enjoy our work. So you have this fine balance between not, you know, honoring the work, not diluting the work, but making it accessible and presenting it in interesting ways. I mean, Shakespeare at the time was a populist writer. I mean, people always think of, you know, forget that now, but he was a playwright for the masses. You know, he wouldn't have survived and been able to do what he did if those characters and those storylines weren't accessible. They would have just thrown things. The groundlings would have thrown things and left and not come and seen him again. So I think in a way I am trying to honor the author. I was trying to honor the author, whether they be dead or alive, and try and sort of in my head have this conversation with them and seek approval of what I'm doing with their work. And sometimes I have access to those authors, and obviously in this case I don't. So it was a kind of spiritual kind of connection between me and William the boss up there.
So did you achieve one of those goals, to bring people to the theater who are not familiar with
Shakespeare? Well, I think we are, you know, and I mean, I didn't answer your caller's specific question, which was sort of trying to frame it really, which was about, you know, pace. I think we're receiving a lot of, one of the things that people are kind of coming back to us is the clarity of it, how in fact they are surprised how easy it is to follow, with the modern context. I think there are certainly times, as your caller says, you know, where the pace and delivery, and that changes every day. You know, we can drive something through. You can also, it can be determined by an audience how much you think that audience is behind you. Are they enjoying it? Are they really into the play? Are they responding to you? Is there a good synergy between the audience and the protagonists and the actors that on that day? And I think that has an influence. I think sometimes if the actors feel like it's a tough audience, then they'll kind of pace it up. And so what we have is, you know, I come in, or my assistant director comes in, notes the show, and we monitor those things. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, we're bedding into the show. You know, it takes, you know, probably running that show 10 or 12 times, which is probably when your caller came in and saw it, to work out what the natural pace and rhythm of it is.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about doing Shakespeare as an actor. We don't speak that way, obviously, and I wish that we did in some ways, because it's so darn beautiful, much of it. How do you train your mind? Because I can't imagine taking that script and being able to memorize it. I just don't know how you do it. How do you do it?
Well, I think actually the knowledge of how, you know, Shakespeare's language works, it becomes actually easier for me to memorize than a normal script.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's because of the rhythm of the language. I mean, you have this pentameter that you have to follow, and so when you work on your lines and you're like, oh, well, what's the next word? What's the next word? You find these, well, that just fits into, you know, the certain pattern. You'll know when you're missing a word, and so it stops you from memorizing it incorrectly. If you're paying attention to that. And so once you get that in your head and that rhythm of Shakespeare, I find it somewhat easier. Now, the trickier part, I think, for me as an actor in performing Shakespeare is making it clear, because you can understand what it means, and then you can say it and think you're it's perfectly clear. But then somebody's like, what are you talking about? And you know, that's where, you know, I thank all my, you know, professors in my MFA program, because they really, you know, it was a 3-year study of just Shakespeare. Well, not just Shakespeare, but we had a class that was devoted just for Shakespeare. And, you know, breaking apart the metaphors and pinning up certain parts of the metaphors to make it clear, and juxtaposing when you're comparing and contrasting two ideas is a real skill that we don't necessarily do in our everyday speech. We tend to make everything monotone and all on one level, and, you know, we're kind of suppress our emotions as much as possible in our everyday life. And so, you know, these, you kind of have to do the ebbs and flows of you know, what you're saying, and you can't just say it. There has to be real life behind every image. Mm-hmm. So that's the trickiest part, I think, is finding the images and making it clear. And so,
yeah. And my problem in seeing Shakespeare is because I find it difficult. I understand a lot of it, and I've seen a lot of it. But there's something about, and I thought what it was last night, I was thinking about this, that part of it is that you'll say a phrase, and you may want to think of a phrase that you want to say for us, that is so beautiful, that is so to the point, that is so, you know, who Shakespeare is and why everybody loves him all these hundreds of years later. And I find myself, oh, just sort of taking that in, thinking, isn't that beautiful? And I don't want the next sentence to be said, because I'm thinking about what was just said that was so beautiful. Mm. And so it's really hard to keep up with the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as Lindsay said, you try and without overspelling it out, and it's a question of degrees of putting. You have a series of lines, and then what are we actually saying there? And pretty much our process in rehearsal is almost what we did, amongst other things, was just, you know, they would say the lines, and I'd say, what are we saying there? And then they would kind of put that in, like, have that conversation in modern English. And so we would just say, oh, so that's what we're saying there. Mm. And then we would have, you know, we had a person working on text specifically, and we'd say, look, can you look up that word? What does that actually mean? Or what is that? Well, how would that work in our world? And so that was the constant part of the equation. And then obviously what you're trying to do is what is the character arc, you know, like where the journey of that, what is the journey of a scene? We always call it the arc. So, you know, where does a character start and where do they finish up? And what is that journey that they go on through to get from A to B to C? And then we kind of, well, what would that context be? So, you know, what would that, you know, for example, there's a great scene with Emilia and Desdemona in the second act where, well, our second act as it is now, because we just switched it into two acts rather than five or six. But, I mean, we were, you know, they're sitting together, and normally it would be a scene where she would be getting, she's like, as a maid, she would be preparing Desdemona for bed, combing her hair and stuff. And she does, but she's also like doing her nails and they're kind of putting some blusher on a cheek from the blow that she's taken earlier from Othello, and when he thinks, you know, she's being unfaithful to him. And that scene is just, I felt like the two actresses that play that, Maddie Hawkinson and Deb Staples, you know, they really land that scene, you know what I mean? And in the modern actions that they have, and it's very clear, I think, what is going on, but we haven't really fundamentally changed the context of what actually that Shakespeare intended. We're just sort of putting it in a modern framework. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to be, it's a question of balance all the time, you know? And we wanted, my take on this was not to rewrite the text and use the Othello story and put that in modern English. I mean, that's been done, you know, there's movies like Oh, and plenty of other kind of shows that do that. But I wanted to do, something which, you know, as you say, celebrated the beauty and of the language, had all of that and could work, and you could go, hopefully, lose yourself, and just after a while, once you heard that language, then relax and sit back in and just let that flow, and hopefully the clarity of the production and who everybody is to each other. I think it's harder in a traditional show, you know, where everyone's wearing, you know, doublet and hose, and they're Lord something and Lord this, and who are they to that? What's the hierarchy here? You know, whereas in our production, I think it's pretty clear, you know, what the hierarchy is and who everybody is to everybody. And that's what we've tried to do. And you have to do a concept that is meaningful, that works, that serves the play, that honors the play, but that isn't ultimately gimmicky. And I guess everybody decides whether that's worked for them or not.
So let's talk about jealousy for a while. You know, why have it? What's the point of jealousy? You may as well just get rid of jealousy. Yeah. One of my old high school boyfriend's mother said that. Don't ever be jealous. There's nothing. Just a bad thing to be
jealous.
Beware
the green-eyed monster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's, you know, that, and that's just it. Yeah. You say that, and then you think, what a great line, so you can't listen to the next line, because it's such a great line. And the thing that went through my mind in this play is, why the heck does Othello not believe, you know, his honest, beautiful, lovely, trustworthy wife, Desdemona, and instead is fed by Iago, who's played very well. It's a good Iago. Why does he believe him instead of her? What is this jealousy?
Well, I think one of the things I tried to bring into my incarnation of Othello is that, you know, he's confused at first, and he's not a naturally jealous person, and he's in, you know, it, I don't think it comes easy. I think he fights it pretty much the whole way through until he actually kills her. It's really tearing him apart. I don't think he's all the way down that road. Even after he kills her, he's still, you know, trying to figure it out. Like,
was that a spoiler alert?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I mean, well, you know, it's not a.
It's all right. Really, it's been around a while. We should know.
You'd be surprised. Huh?
Yeah, I know some people don't know. So I apologize if anybody has. But I think, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you go to the play to go through the journey, not to know the ending. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing is that people forget is that Othello doesn't see everything that they get to see. So, and this is a new love, and this is someone that he's been in battle with, and someone that he's trusted with his own life. And so there's a camaraderie, and there's a trust that happens there as well. And so, you know, despite that, everybody who's watching the play knows that Iago is not trustworthy. Everybody in the play, not just Othello, thinks that Iago is one of the most honest people in their camp. Othello even says he thinks that Iago might not be just, and I'll have some proof. And so when he gets presented with the proof, which is, you know, the handkerchief, you know, that causes confusion, and which, you know, he's feeding off of. I think one of the most jealous character in the play is Iago, if anybody, and so I think he's feeding off of Iago's jealousy, in a weird way, and so you know, he gets taken down this path that is eating him alive and tearing him apart, and so that's that's the toughest part about playing the part, is having to go from, you know, this confusion and jealousy and love being torn between this sense of honor with Iago and this love for Desdemona, which is somewhat of an unfamiliar thing for him as far as his vulnerability and his access to emotions to this woman. And I think it is, he genuinely loves her, but he's utterly confused and consumed with jealousy by the end. So
you just said, you explained it to me, so now this band of brothers, they served in battle together, makes it make much more sense to me.
Yeah,
because I hear from people all the time, the band of brothers.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to note that when in the motorcycle club culture, recruitment often comes after... you know, heavy recruitment to these clubs comes often after, you know, military conflict. And in fact, you know, that's how some of the original gangs were formed, because they were, you know, there were people coming out of Vietnam or Korea, and, you know, even and who were just forming this brotherhood, and they're coming back into civilian life. They miss the, you know, of like, the rush and the camaraderie and the intensity and the stakes, the gravitas that goes with fighting shoulder to shoulder with someone, and then where do you put that energy? And it almost feels like that there's a deficiency in one's life going back into a so-called normal life. So for some of these guys, they're seeking to rekindle that and have something that where that gives them the same sort of purpose in civilian life, and so they create their own structure that facilitates that, you know, so it is I think with Iago as well, you know, as Lindsay said, he's referred to all the way through the play by so many of the protagonists, so the other protagonists, as good, honest Iago, and he's the person that, in a way, I mean, for me, with the productions I've often seen that are disastrous are the ones where, you know, you've got this sort of mustachio twirling kind of villain, and the fact is, I think that, you know, what Jerry Nugent, who plays Iago, I think brilliantly kind of conveys, you know, we talked about the complexities of that, of him being, you know, not even sure why he's doing something sometimes, or looking at the consequence of his action and being, you know, satisfied, but also strangely moved that I created that turmoil, I created that emotion. There's a moment, you know, where Othello breaks down and he says, the pity of it, Iago, and Jerry just looks at him for a while, and you can see him toying with this sort of this conflict within him. I created that, and I hate this man, but also I'm kind of feeling strangely moved by him, and I've been with him a long time. And so it's confused. It's not always, you know, clean cut, black and white decision what's going on, because I think that's the people like him, like Iago, you know, they're never simple. They're complex characters. If you look at most serial killers, you know, they're not just your average, you know, they function, they're not that dissimilar to us. It's just that they're taking their actions to greater extreme. And because that rationale switches in their head to what is acceptable as opposed to most people. And I think, you know, he's feeling completely looked over. Most of us at some point in our life have felt like, you know, we've given our all to something, whether it be to a lover, to a friend, to a job. And then we have been that trust, that faith, that everything we put into that, our heart and soul, our blood, our sweat, our tears, is then kind of like, in our head somewhere, we feel that has been betrayed, that trust has been betrayed, and with that become, you know, there comes an anger and a sadness, and it's then how it manifests in different people, that's the thing. And with Iago, it goes to a complete extreme. But I think that's why people understand that character, or kind of, you know, and with Othello, who is a good man, but, you know, what is the downfall ultimately is his ego. And, you know, I think that's what Shakespeare's writing, these great lessons to us. You know, that these things affect us all. You know, if we can put ego aside, then that's going to be, if our ego is driving us, there will be tears at some time.
Yeah. Could we have to take a pause here? Could you give us a little bit of Shakespeare?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
You mean him, not me, I'm telling you.
You can too, Marty.
No, 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 you don't want that. Trust me.
Sure. This is when Othello has been accused of witchcraft and has eloped with Desdemona, and so he's now come to the court, all the superiors, to defend himself, and he tells the story of how he wooed Desdemona. And so he starts. Her father loved me, oft invited me, still questioned me the story of my life from year to year, the battles, sieges, fortunes that I have passed. I ran it through, even from my boyish days to the very moment he bade me tell it, wherein I spake of most disastrous chances, of moving accidents by flood and field, of hairbreadth escapes in the imminent deadly breach, of being taken by the insolent foe and sold to slavery, of my redemption thence, importance in my travailious history. This to hear would Desdemona seriously incline, and with a greedy ear devour up my discourse, which I observing, took once a pliant hour, and found good means to draw from her a prayer of earnest heart that I would all my pilgrimage dilate. I did consent, and often did beguile her of her tears when I did speak of some distressful stroke that my youth suffered. My story being done, she gave me for my pains a world of sighs. She swore in faith 'twas strange, 'twas passing strange, 'twas pitiful, 'twas wondrous pitiful. She wished she had not heard it, yet she wished that heaven had made her such a man. She thanked me, and bade me, if I had a friend that loved her, I should but teach him how to tell my story, and that would woo her. Upon this hint, I spake. She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them. This is the only witchcraft that I have used.
Thank you. And when we come back, if you would talk about how, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, how you would tell that story in modern language, how you would make sure that the audience, maybe has never seen Shakespeare before, gets that story.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And we'll welcome more phone calls. The show, we should tell you, is at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and it runs through May 6th, so they're still fairly early in production here. If you've seen it, we would love to hear from you. I know there are Shakespeare scholars who are listening, or people who are very familiar with Othello. Or if you're not, call. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Rich, I forgot to thank you for calling, and thank you. And we'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Clements, Artistic Director and Director of Othello, and Lindsay Smiley, who plays Othello in the rep production, is with us. They're in our studios, and we'll take more phone calls in just one moment. So as a director, you listen to Lindsay say that, and then in modern English language, you would analyze what he said or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the things that we do. I mean, obviously we come to the play, all of us, with an understanding. I mean, and certainly something, what I presented the cast with, it was my version of it, my edited version, because we had a very short rehearsal time. So in an ideal world, you'd probably negotiate with your actors on every single line, and you could spend 2 or 3 weeks doing that. We didn't have a chance to do that. So I have to kind of do, if you like, the director's cut. And so I present the actors with that and go, hey, look, this is what we're going to be doing. You know, if you have any concerns, if there are any issues, and I'm sure there will be, or things that you want to line back, you feel like you can maybe lose that line, that's just reiteration there or whatever. And then we negotiate, you know, and serve what we think the play is best, you know. And I'm like trying to do... I've got the overview on it because I'm looking to get the production in a certain time, you know, because there are kind of considerations, like organizational considerations, as well as just the art. And obviously the actors are, you know, often, you know, are passionate about their characters' lines. And, you know, for someone like the characters like Othello and Iago, they have a lot of them. But whereas, like, some of the smaller roles, you know, they maybe only have 12 lines anyway, and you're going to cut six of those. You know, that's it becomes a harder negotiation. And you just, you know, hopefully what we do is we call it table work. And every director works in a different way. I always work, whatever I'm doing, whatever the play, whether it's Shakespeare or a musical or whatever play, I usually sit for at least a week and I go through before we even move it up on its feet, so that the whole cast get a sense and an understanding of what we're shooting for in terms of what the meaning of the text is, shooting for getting a real understanding of what the concept of the production is, what each character has role is in relation to the other roles. Because, you know, you could actually, you can be in a play, your scene might be, you know, with one person, and you might not meet the other 10 or 11 characters throughout. In fact, Roderigo, you know, in this play, who's played by Jonathan Wainwright, he's kind of, you know, his whole scenes are just with, pretty much with Iago. I mean, I've developed that strand even more than it is in the original, but he doesn't really come into contact with anyone because his role is like just entwined with the sort of the evil machinations that are going on between him and Iago. So it's really getting everybody in the room where they understand that. And then in this particular case, we go through the text and we're saying, what are we saying there? So, you know, Lindsay would do a speech like that. And then I would say, and everyone would be in the room and I'd say, well, break that down for us. What does that mean? And then he would go through it line by line and he would just put that into modern English. And then maybe we would do it again and then see how our enhanced understanding.
It's a very elaborate process.
It's a complex one. Yeah.
Joan in Madison. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Joan.
I actually saw the play last weekend and, I hadn't been looking forward to it because I'd seen it several times, and then I heard about the motorcycle, and I thought, oh. But I have to say that it was not, I didn't feel that it was at all gimmicky. I felt like using that huge metaphor of the motorcycle gang really, really helped me understand the motivation of the actors. And another thing that I would like to compliment you on is the chart that you put into the program. It helped, you know, it helped orient me to who was who and who was who to what to who and all of that. And finally, I'd just like to say how incredibly moved I was by the performance. I thought about it all week long, and I continue to do so. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Joan.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to take one more call because we're almost out of time, everyone. Sandy in Muskego, hi.
Hi. First of all, we already renewed our season tickets for next year, so we're looking forward to it.
Thank you.
And my husband and I saw Gerald Nugent in the Stackner Cabaret, The Complete Works of William Shakespeare, comedy. And then we saw him, you know, as Iago. We just got such a kick out of the transformation from a total comedy. He's so good. We love Gerald.
Yes, we do.
And he did such a great job. And that was kind of fun to see.
Thank you. Yeah, he's a wonderful Iago, and you know, gives so many layers and complexities, and you know, to it, and extrapolates the humor, you know, but not at the expense of the character, and he digs deep and dark as well. So it's a great side. A lot of people who know Jerry's work haven't seen him do something that kind of that sort of dark and evil, and you know, he's enjoying it, and our audience is enjoying him too. So thank you.
He's getting hisses sometimes.
Yes, he is. Yeah,
he must love it.
Theater, so
yeah. Like pantomime. Yeah. Yeah.
So what other dream do you have of another Shakespeare play done in a way that would be unusual for us?
Oh, you know, I think the Scottish play. You know, I can't say it, and especially, I just come from a theatrical family where my mother used to kind of kick me out of the house if I mentioned that play. So it's just stayed with me. So I'm not saying it. And The Tempest. You know, those are the two plays probably that would be on my hit list next.
Thank you both so much. Thanks for the performance. Thanks for the rep. It's just a treasure in this town. It really is. You know, you got to have a baseball team. You got to have the Repertory Theater.
Totally.
Yeah. And the lake. And maybe a Harley.
We're all lucky people living here.
We are. Yeah. Thank you. Just to let you know, the show continues through May 6th at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and it's worth seeing. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Thanks to Mark and Lindsay for coming to our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to Brett Jasper, our new producer, for arranging this interview and seeing the show. And we'll be with you tomorrow, everybody.